Hi, everybody. It's the Week in the Tackle podcast, the podcast where we look back at the previous week in football and or soccer, whatever you like, and we tackle the things that we found interesting. I'm Tom Rennie of TalkSport SiriusXM fame. Yeah. Alongside me is a much more famous person who also works for SiriusXM FC, but we're Apple, ESPN, I think he works in your local grocery store. He's a very busy man. It's only Danny Bryan, MLS star Dunseth. Hi, mate. You all right?
I'm good. Rennie, I want to pay you a compliment because your ego, it needs to be gently stroked every once in a while. You're really good at what you do. I don't care what Twitter says about you. I don't care about your meltdowns for West Ham every single weekend. I really enjoy what you do. You're a fantastic. I love being on a hike and listening to you. I think you do a great job. Even when you besmirch my name, and Zaniolo has some fantastic hair dye.
I just couldn't think of anyone else that has ever had frosted tips, but seriously, you're the first person that came to my mind, and I couldn't, Sugar Ray just wouldn't come to me. I didn't know if it would translate. I just feel like I talk about you a lot in my commentaries. I might be obsessed with you.
I love it. It makes me really happy when I'm listening and hearing it. But then more importantly, when I'm getting text messages from around the United States that, dude, what did you do? Rennie's murdering you right now. Or, oh my God, Rennie just used you as a reference point. That was amazing. And I was like, what are you talking about? And it's like, something about frosted tips and how you were a boy band member back in the day. And I was like, sounds about right. Fair,
yeah,
slightly
right.
Aggressive.
Yeah, it's on brand. That's the brand I'm going for. Fair, but slightly aggressive. Listen, loads of things to talk about today. I want to talk about the Premier League title race. I want to talk about Bayer Leverkusen. A little bit about Cole Palmer. Cold Palmer to his friends. Plus our heroes and villains of the week as well. Did you see I got Danny Higginbottom to do a Cole Palmer on the football show on Tuesday?
I did.
A lovely but straight-laced man. I'm trying to loosen him up. I'm essentially like radio tequila for Danny Higginbottom. That's what I'm going for. I'm going to bring him down in the same way I brought you down. But I did get him to do a Cole Palmer, which I enjoyed. Anyway, we'll get to that. Premier League title race, Danny. I'd love your view on this weekend because it was a really interesting one, actually, and maybe a decisive one as well. I know everyone who listens to this knows the story already, but in case, you know, you might have your wife in the car. City won by 5-1 against Luton on the Saturday. We go to Sunday. Liverpool dominate the game against the Crystal Palace team, who, as usual in April, have nothing to play for. They put on a heroic, brilliant performance and win by 1-0. Eze and Elise start together and Palace are good. If they could have played more games together, Roy Hodgson would still be in a job. But don't worry, he'll still have 15 more before retirement. Liverpool have shot after shot after shot, but can't hit the target. But maybe we expected Liverpool, with the Klopp kids, to not be able to win it. For Arsenal, best team in the league this season, for me, stepping back and looking at all their games and performances, should have won it last year, but really did choke last season against a good Aston Villa team, met at the wrong time, probably, either side of the Bayern Munich games and the Bayern Munich game, the first leg. You know, reports of Bayern's demise, greatly exaggerated. They were very good, as we expected them to be, us in the pundit class, at least, certainly on this podcast. Yeah. We thought Bayern would be better than reports suggested. But Villa dominated, Villa won it, and it sort of felt like almost like a mausoleum at Emirates Stadium at the end. To such a degree, there was a narrative of Arsenal fans leaving Emirates Stadium, despite the fact they'd only lost 4 games all season to that point when they went 2-0 down. Danny, is it congratulations to Manchester City? The Sovereign Wealth Fund does it again?
Yeah, potentially. I still think there's twists and turns. And by the way, I would also gently throw in that there was the top 5, maybe potentially 6, maybe potentially 7 that had some big results, because that Newcastle 4-0 throppling, if that's a word, of Tottenham Hotspur and Big Inch.
A throuple is when I think 3 people come together in a couple. David Hay, the haymaker, the boxer's in a throuple with 2 different women. Hell of a life for a boxer. Sorry, Tim.
Okay. Well, then maybe the throuple is Manchester United, Chelsea, and Newcastle at this point for who's close but not close enough. And who
bisexual. It's a bit sexual,
to,
mate.
Yeah.
Don't
well,
go too
close
sexual.
Enough. Potato, potato, or potato, potato. Yeah. Listen, do they win it? I don't know. I keep coming back. Again, I do this all the time. I see, but I do my laundry list of games remaining. And for Arsenal, away at Bayern, away at Wolves, home against Chelsea, away at Spurs, home against Bournemouth, away against Man United and Everton to end the season. Liverpool, who I thought, because of momentum, goal scoring opportunities, and the Klopp effect, had maybe the best advantage because of that rotation and the different variation of players that could come in. That away against Atalanta, Fulham away, Everton away, away at West Ham, Spurs, at Villa, Wolves, tough, but not as tough as maybe Arsenal's schedule. But then Man City start cooking, right? And by the way, Madrid at home, at Spurs, home against Chelsea, at Brighton, at Forest, Wolves, Fulham away, West Ham at home. That, if we're going to go by strength of schedule, is probably the easiest of the top three. So yeah, I think as of right now, it's probably low-hanging fruit to suggest that Man City is the you know, Premier League title contenders, winners, whatever this looks like. But I don't know, man. I feel like there's going to be points dropped. And this idea of choking, this idea of bottling, this idea of throwing it away, I just feel like there's a couple more twists in the turn. And whatever this looks like with regards to Champions League and or Europa League, that could significantly have a say, because one or two extra games in the run-up to the final games of the season, or falling away like Liverpool potentially does after being down 3-0 at home against Atalanta and having to go to Bergamo on Thursday. Mm-hmm. I think all of these things are legitimate conversations, but I don't think we should shy away from Unai Emery and unceremoniously being pushed out the door. You know, he was the guy to follow Arsene Wenger. He takes over a Mesut Ozil and a David Luiz and, you know, the Sven Mislintat, golden balls or golden eye, whichever you want to talk about, sexual again. Everything went sideways at Arsenal. So I believe he is undefeated upon his return at Emirates. I think they drew with PSG. I think he drew, who was it, with Villarreal? And then now he's won with Aston Villa. Really, really incredible. So credit to Aston Villa. They're looking to cement their spot in Champions League after an incredible run in Europa League, an incredible run this season. But yeah, I think for Mikel Arteta, Jurgen Klopp, and specifically Pep Guardiola, the tactics, the decision, the starting 11s, the player rotation, the substitution effects, all of those things, I think we're going to be going over with a fine-tooth comb, depending upon what the result looks like.
Well, let's not do too much more on Aston Villa, because I don't want to make up another hero of the week on the spot because you've nicked it earlier in the program. But I will mention, in terms of Unai Emery, he averages 2.26 points per game in the Premier League at Emirates Stadium, the highest rate of any manager who's been there 10 or more times, a better win percentage, essentially, than Arsene Wenger and Mikel Arteta at Arsenal's home stadium. But of course, he was a failed manager, according to Arsenal Fan TV. In terms of the Arsenal performance, Danny, I would like your view on that, because the reason the choke narrative comes round again, and last year I think they did, and I think there's a fair justification for anyone who thinks last season they choked in those games against Southampton and West Ham, they had another chance and kind of failed to win a league where they were so clear with so few games to go. So I think that will count.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can be sensitive or not to that, but in the end that was. I don't think this will be, because it has been so close between the three. But coming into this game off the back of Bayern, which was a disappointing performance, real tough game to bounce into, I wanted to ask you about the way they set up, because you and I, of course, were at the All-Star game, the very first time that Declan Rice played for Arsenal. And of course, you were standing about 3 feet behind him, taking photographs of Declan Rice and texting me about
it. Not true.
So you're a true friend. Thanks, pal. But we were having discussions then, what was that, July, out in DC, about Kai Havertz, Declan Rice, and Martin Ødegaard being an effective midfield three. Yeah. And in the last 9 or 10 games, Kai Havertz has been the striker. Mm-hmm. And he didn't come to Arsenal to be the striker, but he's really been effective with differing players alongside him, Jorginho coming into midfield, and the Arsenal balance just looked right. In this game, he went with that midfield three that didn't feel like it worked in July. And to my mind, having seen them a lot this season, has never really looked right for any of the players involved. It put the shackles back on Declan Rice, playing in a more withdrawn role. It doesn't suit Kai Havertz being in the melee, and it felt like a melee in this game. And it left Martin Ødegaard, for my money, doing too much to bring Arsenal up the field when he and Rice have done that well together with Jorginho sitting in recent weeks. And I was thinking a bit about the Southampton game last year. And I know Aaron Ramsdale had that howler of a game that cost him it. But also in the match, it was pointed out to me by an Arsenal fan, funnily enough, on the train coming into London on Monday, who oversaw me watching Match of the Day on my phone. And he tapped me on the shoulder and he was like, Arsenal fan. And I was like, yeah. because I, you know, just wanted to have a chat. And so we chatted about the Arsenal performance. And he said he'd done it last year, though. He was fiddling with the team. And what he did in that Southampton game was he played Fabio Vieira ahead of Granit Xhaka in the game.
That's right, yeah.
When Granit Xhaka had been having a great season, but he thought, you know what, I need someone a bit more attacking, creative. I'm going to tweak it in what in the end turned it out to be a devastating match. And I just wondered, Danny, we're talking about learning from the past. We're talking about, you know, Unai Emery overthought the Tottenham game a few weeks ago and made so many tweaks, he butchered his own team and they got thrashed by Tottenham. How much do you think Arteta, A, hasn't learned from his mistakes of last season, and B, is at fault for the loss of performance against Aston Villa?
Endless debate. And you're spot on, because it's the first thing that I noticed when the starting 11 came out. I was like, oh, Gabby Jesus is in. Oh, wait, Trossard's in. Okay, so he's going to play. He's reverted. This is going back to December. Because this run coincides with Gabby Jesus' unavailability. It also coincides with him playing higher and Jorginho coming in the team and Declan being as more of a number eight. You know, Odegaard finding a little bit more space, a little bit higher, because he's freed up of a little bit more responsibility and almost playing as a false nine underneath another false nine in a lot of ways. I like Trossard. I've got nothing against Martinelli. I think Trossard coming off the bench has been fantastic. I think he's an unbelievable player. But it's the first thing I noticed, because for me, when I look at Arsenal, and I know my man, Mariah, Dave in Michigan, and I bust chops back and forth. Zinchenko, he can have a level 10 or he could have a level 2. And you just don't know. And both of those levels can be in the same match. Gabriel and Saliba are arguably the center back tandem of the season. But at the same time, and we've seen this, and something that I point out, the aggressiveness of Gabriel to get so touch tight and so close, it's very Rudiger-esque, his physicality, as opposed to, do you need to or do you want to? And then Saliba's forced to cover and track. And so when you go back to the Southampton game, what was the big conversation? It was, well, Saliba was injured, so that kind of tooled the back line. If he wasn't injured, they wouldn't have dropped points. Okay, great. But now you're in a similar situation and you are dropping points. And whether that's mistakes or it's crossbars or it's posts or it's missed opportunities, it's great goalkeeping, blah, 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 blah. At the end of the day, 2-0, still 2-0. Mm. I go back to the conversation you and I had heading into the January transfer window. And this idea that profit and sustainability, which is just ludicrous at this stage, because I guess now all you got to do is sell, you got to play follow the queen and just sell hotels to yourself to offset what your losses are, or you're relegated and then you don't have to answer to the EFL because those losses weren't incurred in the EFL. But if you do get promoted and come back, then you'll be immediately docked points, not just this year, but for the following few years. And if you're Everton, you're saying, what in the flying squirrel is going on? How is Chelsea not being charged? Whatever. That's neither here nor there. I got a caught off on a big tandem. But anyways, back to the January profit and sustainability conversation with Arsenal. You and I were saying, well, what about a Vlahovic from Juve? Mm. What about a 50 million pound striker? What could you go get an Osimhen? Could you go get Ivan Toney from Brentford? Which now I would have said maybe a week ago, do you need Ivan Toney with the way that you're now playing Kai Havertz? I think ultimately to your question about Mikel Arteta, this is why I tried to unravel it backwards. He is going to tweak. Every manager is going to tweak. And they're going to think about where, as they dissect the opponent, the strengths and the weaknesses, they'll look at the previous three games. They'll chop it all up with their coaching staff. They'll think about where the mismanagement is from the opponent. Where can they get something better from their group? And ultimately, there'll be the endless debate. Should we start Gabby? Should we bring him off the bench? Should we put him on that left-hand side? Well, what about Trossard's form? Martinelli was pretty reliable all season long. Well, okay, if we drop Jorginho, what are we missing? If Declan's being asked to play in that position, do we lose that driving forward instead of him kind of pivoting and shadowing? If Kai's in, is it balance or is it disbalanced on that left-hand side? And who's going to cover? Can we get him up high enough? What does that mean for? So I think as they're going through all this, inevitably, the responsibility for Arteta is, how do I get the best? How do I get advantage? and what is the risk I'm willing to take? Mm. It didn't work. Now I'm intrigued to see what the second leg looks like at Bayern Munich on Wednesday. And then more importantly, what is it at Wolves? Tricky test, a really tricky test for Mikel Arteta and Arsenal.
Fixtures for Arsenal, I've got them here just to read them out. Wolves away, Chelsea at home, Spurs away, Bournemouth home, Man U away, Everton home. I just don't think they're going to win every game. There's some real tough ones in there. And I say this a lot to people. A lot of our listeners aren't from England. It is so much harder for a team from London to win the Premier League. I always think that because there are so many derbies. And Chelsea at home and Spurs away, if you can get through those games with 6 points, you know, I'd be stunned. I'd be really stunned because Chelsea and Spurs will do anything they possibly can. There'll be extra levels. There'll be Crystal Palace levels of motivation to stop Arsenal from winning those matches. And that could be a difference maker. And that gives me a nice segue to Crystal Palace, Danny. And I wanted to ask you about the game. Well, two things on that game. One is about Crystal Palace because the gargantuan effort they put in was incredible. And I know a few Liverpool fans were pretty pissed off about how much a Crystal Palace team with nothing to play for put into that game. But I wanted to ask you about missing chances because a few years ago when Liverpool were at their absolute peak, the front three of Mane, Firmino and Mo Salah, the great thing about that three, of which there was so much, but the greatest thing for my money at least, and I got to watch them quite a lot at the time, was that they always looked for Salah. And there was a moment in this game, and it led to that row, was it Burnley famously, where they were rowing about not setting each other up. You're meant to pass to me and you don't, you know, that sort of thing. And there was a moment in this game where Darwin Nunez was going through on goal and Mo Salah was herring in on the right-hand side, clearly screaming for the ball. Sadio Mane would have passed to him. Roberto Firmino would have passed to him. Darwin Nunez took a shot. It was his 100th shot of the season, the commentator said. The most in the league. And I think he scored 9 or 10 league goals. So it's a 1 in 10 ratio of shots, which ain't great for a Liverpool centre forward. And the reason I'm bringing that up is 21 shots in the match, 6 on target. If you care about XG, and I go in and out on things like XG, it tells you something, it doesn't tell you everything.
Yeah.
But their total XG against Palace was 2.87, Liverpool's most on record in the 15 years we've been looking at XG. Opta have been looking at it. It's not been very public, but they've studied it since then. It's their most in a game since it began. And it's the most in a game since a game between Brighton and Norwich a couple of years ago. So they should have statistically won this game 3-0, but they kept missing the target over and over and over again, coupled with a few decent stops from Dean Henderson as well. Tell us how that happens, why that happened.
By the way, do you know XG does not take into account the dominant foot of the player?
Yes, and also, is it someone told me the quality of the player as well? So it could be Erling Haaland in that position, or it could be Brian Dunseth.
Yeah.
You've got the same XG.
Yeah, and for example, Lionel Messi's XG is the exact same if the ball's on his left foot or his right foot, which I thought was rather interesting. And I think it's still something that you got to work through. That I do think the data is incredibly helpful and tells an incredible story, but I agree with you. It doesn't tell the whole story. You got to be careful with the minefield of data right now. The Darwin Nunez thing, I will always, this is coming from a Manchester United fan that absolutely wanted Darwin Nunez two, three seasons now ago when he was at Benfica. I really like him. I think he's a really good player. I think, unfortunately, he came in at the same season as Erling Haaland, and Erling Haaland put up absurd superhero type of numbers, where Darwin Nunez is a very serviceable striker in the Premier League. I wouldn't say he's elite, but he's a very good striker. But he misses a lot of chances. He needs chances. A weird thing happens. There's a weird thing that happens with confidence and crisis of confidence with players. And what becomes just this repetition, finishing, don't think, react, starts to turn into don't react, think. Because in the back of your mind, it'll be like, don't miss. Can't miss this one. Oh my God, this is so easy. Like, yeah, okay. And then it's also, I know I can play him, but I need to finish this. And it becomes an I instead of a we. And I'm not suggesting that's where Darwin Nunez is, but I certainly think these players are capable of, in moments, decisive moments, in the back of their mind, subconsciously, being a little bit selfish. And strikers are, I think, inherently greedy because they are elite level goal scorers. But there becomes those moments where you're like, why didn't he pass the ball? Why was the weight of the pass wrong? Why didn't you find his left foot? Why did you play it to his right foot? All those little things. So yeah, it becomes a firestorm of, you know, crisis of confidence. And that's why for me, when 2 weeks ago, when we were talking about Liverpool, I thought Liverpool was going to, I thought they were too good. I thought with the options they had in the midfield, with the options they had in the front three, that they could rest, they could rotate, they could impact off the bench, and they were going to score goals. And for some reason, it's just weird what's happening right now with Liverpool. Mm-hmm. If I was Tim Horsey and a Liverpool supporter, I would be pulling my hair out trying to figure out why in the flying squirrel this team can't find the back of the net when it feels like they should be up 3 or 4-0 in halftime. By the way, was I the only one that felt like Virgil van Dijk was extremely deep in this game? Like keeping players on side? Like, it felt like he was so nervous about what was happening around him that he had to give himself like an extra 4 or 5 yards to kind of cover and protect and find the balance. And by the way, Andy Robertson, that save off the goal line was extraordinarily athletic. But yeah, full credit to Palace, man. Again, they're always going to be a mid-table team. They're always going to be somewhere between 7th and somewhere between 14th every single season. But it just shows you that when they are 100% healthy, they're pretty decent, man. That performance they put in the Etihad not too long ago, they can cause you some problems.
To your point on Virgil van Dijk, I think he was concerned about Jean-Philippe Mateta. Talk about most improved players in the league. I was chatting to some coaches at Crystal Palace not too long ago, and I was like, oh, Mateta, like, what's he like? You know, you're not really playing him up front very much. And essentially, I'm going to paraphrase what they said here, nicest guy in the dressing room, control of a trampoline. And in the last year, that has really, really, really improved. You know, you talk about players who come to the Premier League and take their chance and grow into it and develop their game. His ball control recently been exceptional. His goal scoring has been really good. His line leading has been great. Yeah. I think at this particular moment in time, he's probably the best number nine in the league. And I don't back away from that. Last 5-8 games, he's been fantastic. Final one on Crystal Palace. I did want to ask you about this because there was a few people whinging about just how much effort they put in. Mm-hmm. And it was reminding me a little bit of the famous game in 1995 when West Ham played Man United, the final game of the season. And a win for Man United would have made them champions. It was the year that Blackburn Rovers were Premier League champions. They lost at Anfield to Liverpool. All sorts going on. Jamie Redknapp scored and Kenny Dalglish's Blackburn manager at Anfield. You know, brilliant scenes in the end. But a goal for Man United and they're champions. And it became this almost duel between West Ham goalkeeper Ludo McClosco and Andy Cole up front for Man United. The game finished 1-1 in the end. Michael Hughes for West Ham, Brian McClair for Man United. And it was chance after chance after chance after chance. West Ham had nothing to play for. Mm. They were safe. It was done. But they put in this effort that I forget the word he used now, Alex Ferguson. But post-game, it was like the effort West Ham put in today was disgusting. Or something like that. It may have been that word. It was something similar because he was like, I just couldn't believe how much effort they put into stopping us winning the league. Where in the end, it didn't mean anything to them. And just a question, Danny, on why you think that happens. Why you think teams like Crystal Palace and West Ham, you know, 30 years ago or whatever, find it within themselves to put in these incredible performances when there is nothing on the line? Because I would expect from the outside it to be the other way.
Yeah, I think it's ridiculous. I think you're not you, but I think you question the professionalism of an athlete and the desire to win. Because as much as people think it's about money, it's not about money. It's about winning the game. That's why these guys play the game. There was never a game that I went into that I didn't want to win. I wanted to kill you. I wanted to take everything that you had. I'm not joking. I went into every game thinking that I was going to win. Even when I like subconsciously and in reality knew we didn't have a chance, I still like, I wasn't going to let you score. I was going to kick the living shit out of you. Sorry, Tim. I was going to do everything that I could to make sure that I gave my team the best opportunity. And whether that was within the gray areas of the game or that was me physically just trying to dominate somebody, I took it personally. I really did. And so when you asked me that, you just used a reference point from 30 years ago. Stuff of legends. Like, don't think for a second that these guys don't think about stuff like that. Like, when you look around that locker room and you're going to bat, like, yeah, you can turn over. Yeah, you know, you're thinking about vacation. You've already booked what your plans are for the summer, your wife and your partner and your family. You know exactly what you're going to do. In the meantime, let's take them down. Like, what do we have to lose? Nothing. So go out, compete, play. And by the way, not for nothing, think about it from this perspective. If you're a player for Crystal Palace, right, and you're playing Liverpool at Anfield, you don't think for a second you're in the shop window? You know, you talk about Mateta and the development. You don't think for Eze and those type of players that there's not an opportunity for higher wages, for a bigger club, for Champions League football, like all the maybe get into the international scene with their respective national teams? All of those things are at play in games, on top of just playing for the pride of your club. Yeah, I think there's just something there. Inherently, there has to be some type of conversation of you're playing. How do I explain this correctly? When you play for a club, you represent the city. When you play for the club, you represent the fans. When you play for a team and you're playing at the highest level, you inevitably take it for granted. But at the same time, there's that moment that you know you're not going to, it's not going to last forever. So how do you capture that singular moment of I'm going to go out, I'm going to give, this could be my last game. I could blow an ACL on Monday at training. That could be career ending. I don't know how to verbalize it correctly, but yeah. when people go to the final day of the season, they're like, what do they have to play for? F-ing everything. Sorry, Tim. They have everything to play for because it's opportunity. It's opportunity to win. And when you win, crazy things happen on the other side.
But then the previous week, the same team would have played 100%. Against Brentford and lost 2-0 because they don't give a shit. Sorry, Tim.
Well, they'll look like it. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
Listen, I want to talk about one other quick thing on this and then move on. And the Man City of it all sticks in my craw a little bit, as you know. I do struggle with Man City, the way the club is run, the way they've grown the club. And I hate even stepping away from it being Man City, the fact that they're on the verge of a sixth Premier League title and they win so often and so regularly that they kind of blur into one in a lot of ways as compared to like Leicester's title win or Leverkusen's title win in the Bundesliga or, you know, even West Ham winning in Prague, whatever. These things that don't often happen, when they happen, they become memorable. City's title wins all become kind of blurred into one. And Bilbao, of course, last week, the flotilla, the celebrations, their first trophy in 40 years. My friend from Bilbao flew back over there and had 3 days with his school chums at the town hall with, they said a million on the streets. I'm sure it was less, but whatever. Let them have it. You know, incredible. Compared to, oh, look, Real Madrid won another Copa del Rey. You know, no one gives a Sorry, Tim. And I just, there's this element of football, Danny, and I wanted to see what you think about it because I just struggle with it. You know, last year or the year before, I saw a video on a Celtic fan Twitter handle, and it was this amazing drone footage. And I love the city of Glasgow. My family are Rangers fans, so, you know, don't at me. But, you know, we're Rangers people. And the Rennies have been coming from Glasgow for hundreds of years. So what can I say? I'm great-great-grandfathered into this. There's an amazing video of a drone flying over Glasgow, and there are thousands upon thousands of Celtic fans celebrating winning the title, their 150th league or whatever it was a couple of years ago. And the line on the top was, and people say that we don't enjoy it anymore. People say we don't celebrate the title because we always win it. Well, look at this. Of course we do. And it really got to me, and it sticks with me a couple of years later, because it's not that we don't think you enjoy it. We know you enjoy it. I know from the tweets of Liam Gallagher that he very much enjoys winning the Premier League every year. I'm sure you do love it, Manchester City, but I just don't think you should get to enjoy it every year. And that's what gets to me, and that's what annoys me. And that's what I think when we got to a situation now where City have won what it'll be 6 of 7. I think we've got to try actively to stop that from happening. What happened in the Bundesliga for very different reasons was maybe the worst thing that possibly could have happened, in my view, to German football, Bayern being 10-year champions. The Leverkusen victory, I think, is phenomenal and great for the game. The Juventus domination in Serie A, that ending has been amazing for Serie A, probably the most exciting league in European football across the last 3 to 5 seasons without Juve being in that conversation. Those brief few moments where we thought Girona might challenge. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
You know, even though they're owned by the City Group, that was quite thrilling. And I can't feel happy for them. A, because they win too much. And I do think that matters for the health of the sport, the health of the game. And B, because of the way they've gone about it. We just, at this moment, don't know if they played by the same financial rules as everyone else. And if they didn't, then they essentially stole those titles off whoever came second, including Jose Mourinho as Man United all those years ago.
Yeah, well, however they got there is going to be endless debate until whatever the hell is happening and they can get their ducks in a row. And the allegations to the charges to the final say, and then ultimately what the appeal is going to look like. This is going to be drug out for a long, long time. What I would say is, and this is taking my Manchester United fan hat off, the way that, and again, the finances that have bled into these opportunities, they've been extraordinarily lethal with the way that they've built their roster. And I know the money in which they have been able to do so is the major talking point, but they are a very well-run team. They know what they want. They are so proactive in the market. They are very rarely reactive in the market. Yes, they can afford to miss, which they certainly have done so. Calvin Phillips is a perfect example where they can basically waste away a £50 million player and give him to you.
Yeah. Well, they put lead in his boots. Christ.
That's a conversation for another day or for a previous week in the tackle.
For never, ever again. We've done it once and never again, thankfully.
But listen, in a weird way, I really respect the way that they've built this team over the last 6 years. That being said, if these charges and or allegations are proven to be true, then I'm really intrigued to see the manner in which they are held accountable. But in the meantime, I would say the best thing to happen this year is that it is a 3-horse race, that they will be pushed to the limits. And when it's all said and done, they probably will be at the top lifting the trophy and potentially lifting another Champions League trophy. But in the meantime, yeah, I think it's something that's always going to be in the background and a reference point to what's going on in real time when we kind of pull back the curtain and look in the past.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. When it happens, we'll do a bit more on that.
If
and when
happens.
We find out if it happens and when it happens, we'll do some more. I just struggle that even, you know, chatting to that, going back to the guy I spoke to on the train, and I just said to him, you can't beat a country, you know, and that in the end, that will be the overriding narrative. They've stolen the game for us, in my view, and strong regulation is the only way forward. You can't let a team just buy Mateus Nunez, for example, off Wolverhampton Wanderers for £50 million, a record transfer for like 17 of the 20 teams in the league, just to try him out. They bought him just to try him out for what would be a record fee for others. And it's unacceptable, frankly. Got to be stopped. Listen, before we get to Heroes and Villas, one final thing I wanted to talk to you about, and that was, is it getting a bit cold in here? Maybe I should do my zip up a little bit. Let's talk a bit about a cool Palmer. I will say, I really
great
hated that. I really hated it. Until I watched it and I was like, I kind of love it.
Yeah.
So he
dropped like 25 goals this year in all competitions. It kind of grew on you.
Seeing fans do it in the stands at Stamford Bridge on Monday, I actually liked it. It's rare. It's a rare thing to see someone
creative
make an action be their thing. And there were kids doing it, but there were adults doing it. I saw like an 8-year-old boy do it, and I saw what must have been a 7-year-old woman do it, right? I'm sold. I've turned around. I've changed my mind. I like it. But I wanted to ask you about him as a player and what your thoughts are on his year, because, you know, I saw him very close, like a foot away at Selhurst Park recently. I went to Palace against Chelsea, and there's a bit at Selhurst Park where the home team go into the tunnel and the away team go into that porter cabin next to the south stand. It's really weird. But they walked directly past you. And I was just sitting there or standing there chatting to a couple of colleagues, and the Chelsea players like come past you. The first person I saw was Petrovic, the goalkeeper, who looks like a bouncer, like 6'3", muscular, looks like he could do a bit of MMA or whatever, like scary looking geezer.
New England Revolution legend, yep.
Yes, and the guy who followed him was Cole Palmer, who looks kind of a little bit like he's never grown a muscle. Like, he still looks a little bit like someone planted him and it hasn't sprouted as yet. Like, there's no muscle on him.
Like, he's lean.
Very lean. Yeah. He looks a little bit like he is unwell in a South Dakota winter. Like, it looks so unwell. So I didn't, you know, it doesn't look like a footballer, basically, is my point. Like, a lot of footballers kind of fit a profile, physical profile, muscular profile. I remember years ago when Joe Cole was at West Ham as a boy, and everyone was like, when he puts a bit of muscle on, he's going to be terrific. There's no muscle on Cole Palmer. But watching him play against Everton specifically, but across the season, the same amount of goals as actual Erling Haaland right now, potentially going to be the Premier League's top goal scorer this season in this pretty bang average Chelsea. The gliding over the field, the flicks around the corner, the finishes, obviously, the being in the right place at the right time for the header, the anticipation for the lob over Jordan Pickford, the bollocks to say, get lost, Madueke and Jackson. I'm taking this penalty because I'm cold, Palmer.
After already having a hat trick. Yeah.
Give me the ball. I want the fourth. Get lost. And still taking it and scoring it. All of that, when you consider, Dunny, that, you know, Mateus Nunez, I mentioned earlier on, City are being linked with Florian Wirtz at Bayer Leverkusen and Lucas Paqueta again at West Ham to play that sort of role. And you're a bit like, you had him. Is this not him? Is this not the guy you wanted?
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about what your thoughts are on Cole Palmer now and why the hell he's not playing for Man City.
Yeah, I don't know if he got impatient, but I'm actually watching the Man City documentary on Netflix right now.
Underdog story.
Well, you almost forget how many games he did play. You know, he did play a lot of games, but it was more like the Oscar Bob situation where he's coming in for a game here and a game there. And, you know, it's not like the Phil Foden story, but I mean, listen, the Phil Foden, credit to Foden, because Foden hung around. Foden could have left. Foden could have forced himself out. I mean, in the beginning of Pep's reign, remember, he was talking about Phil Foden, but at the time, how was he ever going to, you had David Silva, you had Ilkay Gundogan, you had Bernardo Silva, you had Kevin De Bruyne, who had Leroy Sané, Riyad Mahrez. I mean, you had all these players and you're like, well, Raheem Sterling, like, well, if he's that good, play him. Listen, you can, talking about ruthlessness and efficiency in the market, we can talk about being an England player. We can talk about being a homegrown product. We can talk about all that money going back into the coffers and being used against profit and sustainability for Man City. I think this is the transfer of the summer. He's by far the most consistent and best player for Chelsea. For everybody else that's had kind of glimpses or looks and like, oh man, good game today. Every single game, he's at an 8 or a 9. He is at an 8 or a 9 every single game. He is a constant threat. His work ethic is phenomenal. His gait, his run is so smooth. He's inside, outside. He's 1v1. He's combination passes. Even that first goal, you know, inside, outside, first time finish, the way he opens up his hips and kind of just guides it with the left foot past Pickford, catching Pickford off his line, reading the buildup on the pass, just all of those things. It's no surprise it's in Gareth Southgate's squad. I would be really interested to see, looking forward and predictive starting 11s and effects of players off the bench. I think he plays a huge role for England at the Euros. He's phenomenal, man. He's ruthless. He doesn't come off as arrogant, even though you have to have arrogance with the way that he plays, but he comes off so confident. And I love the fact that he was like, "It's off. It's mine. We'll get to the reaction at some point, hopefully. But yeah, I loved exactly how smooth and under control he's constantly looking, and he's got a little FU in him too. He's got a little bite in him. So it's hard not to watch him and enjoy what he does.
We're going to get to heroes and villains, but do you want to have a say on the penalty and them rowing over the ball?
I will in heroes and villains.
Well, let's get to heroes and villains. And shall we start maybe with our villains of the week? Who's your villain, Danny?
My villain of the week is actually going to be, you know, when you want leadership, you look for a manager that can actually verbalize his opinion. You look for a manager that stands up and is accounted for when things are going horrifically wrong over the course of the season. You look for a manager that's probably a little bit of transparency with regards to why there's so many injuries, tell me what your game model is, because it's not as clear and obvious as you think. So I don't know if he's my hero or my villain, but I went with Erik ten Hag being asked about the potential for the worst finish for Manchester United, which would be seventh or below, and he just got up and walked away. Nothing says leadership to me like that.
Huh?
I've not answered this question, huh?
What did you make to Garnacho liking a tweet from Mark Goldbridge, YouTuber and TalkSport presenter, saying words to the effect of Ten Hag blaming Garnacho because he won't take off the big earners?
You mean Arsenal fan TV? I mean, sorry, Manchester United fan TV? I mean, just low-hanging fruit. He certainly didn't accidentally like the tweet. Let's put it that way. He might have realized after liking the tweet that he better unlike the tweet. But, you know, listen, I think it falls in the same category as Jadon Sancho, as Marcus Rashford, as now Anthony. Oh, man, you're walking me down a dangerous path. It's understandable and somewhat justifiable what the season has looked like because of injuries. And at the same time, how can you justify not adjusting your game model to everything that you're dealing with and being nothing more than a team that can dump a ball into the channel and hope to God that your athleticism can create a chance? And how can you, if having all of these injuries and all of these players unavailable, not change your defensive structure at all? Because I've never seen a team that is easier to play through than what we've seen this season.
Still got a point in a game. You should have lost 8-0 though. So, you know,
crazy.
The badge still counts for something.
Is there a positive that you only gave up 12 shots in the first half as opposed to?
I mean, Bruno Fernandes, I got to move us on, but I did think he was fantastic. That was a
good game. He was a good game.
Yeah, not for the first time. You know, we criticize him for being a bit of a dick.
That's you. Sorry, you do.
Well, the world does, because he is on the field a massive dick, and not in a good way. Bad dick energy, some would say. Sorry, Tim. But he was fantastic.
You owe him another sorry, because you said twice. Sorry, Tim.
Sorry, Tim. I've got two villains for you this week. I'm going to merge them seamlessly. Yeah. Number one, because they're the same thing. It's players not doing their basic jobs, and it really pisses me off. It's players just not doing the basics right. And if you are, I don't know, Lionel Messi, Bernardo Silva, whatever, do something different because you've got amazing technical skill. If you don't have that, just do your job. Do your job, get paid. Number one was my villain of last week, but I didn't want to do him again this week in full. Muric in goal for Burnley. Burnley desperate for a win. Brilliant goal scored by Josh Brownhill. They're beating Brighton, deservedly so. They played really well. Sanderberg plays it back to the goalkeeper, and he can't do a simple piece of ball control on his goal line. And I saw people say, you're never meant to pass the ball directly back to the goalkeeper on his goal line. F*** off. Sorry, Tim. If you give him a little P-roller on his goal line, you should be able to control it, look up and clear the ball. And instead, it goes underneath his studs and goes into the back of the net. But Burnley ain't going to stay up this season. But that was 2 weeks in a row. Last week, he kicks it against Calvert-Lewin and it goes in his own net. He is a one-man kamikaze mission to get Burnley relegated. Like, he's absolutely freaking useless. And if you're James Trafford, who's been pretty bad this season, you might be saying, mate, I might be bad, but this geezer is fucking useless. Sorry, Tim. He's got to go. But the other one, I saw it last night, and I don't know enough about Ante Budimir, but if you haven't seen this, Daddy, you have to see it. Osasuna in action, yeah. 99th minute penalty. He gets the penalty, the 32-year-old forward, and he's like, right, I'm going to wait till the keeper goes down, Harry Kane style, and then pop it in the other corner. But then
I think he tried the Panenka. I think he brain farted Panenka.
I think he's trying to send the keeper the wrong way, but then tries to change to Panenka.
Yeah, yeah.
Way through when he sees the keeper go, and he does a half try and knock it in the corner, half Panenka, yeah. And kicks it so softly, the goalkeeper who went down was able to get up and then catch it because there was no meat behind it. And so I kind of make him the villain as well. Just do your job. Do your job.
It's amazing.
Kick it straight, score goal.
I thought he kicked his heel. Like there was so little power generated off of it. I mean, Simone Zaza is like, okay, cool. Like you can hold my beer. my hero was Lionel Messi at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City. 72,000 people there. He put on a show, had an incredible assist, hit a banger of a goal. I mean, that push forward, turn, pivot, and smashing the ball over the goalkeeper, Tim Melia. Incredible. I mean, listen, I'm a Messi guy. I'm more extroverted, introverted with regards to playing. I love Lionel Messi. He's the best in the world. He's untouchable for me. Incredible what he's capable of doing. And in those moments, like we saw, capable of turning it on at the highest level. And that turn and that smash was extraordinary. On top of the assist that he had earlier, it was a big response game for Tata Martino's Inter Miami after getting absolutely taken apart down in Monterrey during the midweek in CONCACAF Champions Cup. So, yeah, it's a big summer of football here in the United States, and Kansas City once again showing that they show up at Arrowhead Stadium where the Kansas City Chiefs play. 72,000 people there. And even Patrick Mahomes, a little handshake, the quarterback of Kansas City, even wearing like those gigantic blue blocker Ray-Bans that he had on, shaking hands to see Lionel Messi. Fantastic goal, man.
My hero, we kind of spoke about it a little bit earlier on. Ollie Watkins is my hero. 19 Premier League goals this season. Best ever campaign by an Aston Villa striker in the Premier League era. Probably having Aston Villa's second best ever Premier League season following the first ever year in 92 when they probably should have won the league with Dalian Atkinson and Dean Saunders and that brilliant team, showing they never won it. Wonder what history would be like. We should do like the Americans or something, like they did win it. I'd love to see that show. The High Castle or whatever it was, the other one. But he's been fantastic. And the goal to win it was brilliant. But, when you recall, Steven Gerrard was trying to make a choice between Ollie Watkins and Danny Ings only about, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
And the decision was made by Unai Emery in about 6 minutes. And he's developed under Unai Emery into the striker that he is right now, that does everything, runs in behind, holds it up, wins headers. Elite level forward the way he's played this season. But there was a great bit in his post-match interview where he scored this 90-odd minute winner, the second goal, brilliant chip over the goalkeeper. And he said, I don't think I'd have scored that 2 years ago. I don't think I'd have scored it. I've worked on my composure. And now I feel like in those chances, I know how to score. And I just thought it was a really fantastic thing to say from someone who's always been a very, very good player.
Yeah.
Boy, 20 mil. But making that leap forward is the player themselves, the coach, the team. It's all got to come together at the right team at the right time. And it is for Ollie Watkins right now. And so I was really pleased for him to score that goal. I think he's great. Mm-hmm. Right. There you go. That's it for the program. We don't pick a winner of the heroes and villains because we didn't think it through. Plus, there's no further time. That's Brian Dunseth over there. I'm Tom Rennie. This has been the Week in the Tackle podcast. If you've watched the program on YouTube or Spotify, you can listen as a podcast on all podcast platforms. If you listen as a podcast and think, I wonder what those guys look like. Jason Statham and Sugar Ray. On a budget, if you're interested. But you can find out if I'm lying or not by watching on both YouTube and Spotify. Tim Horsley produced the program. We will see and speak to you next week.